presiding over the trial had resigned. A few days later, the Americans were on a charter plane out of the country, except for one individual on the NDI team who insisted on remaining in Egypt as an act of solidarity with his Egyptian colleagues. The popular reaction in Egypt was quite negative and contradictory. Angry protesters accused the government of inventing a case against the Americans only to cave to American pressure and injure the nation's pride. The Muslim Brotherhood released a statement insisting that they had played no role in their release. The defendants were subsequently tried in absentia that summer and convicted. That angered me, and the fact that our people were safely home meant that in future meetings with Egyptian officials I could allow myself to be more demonstrative in my protest over the injustice. A few weeks after their wrongful conviction, Mohamed Morsi, the Brotherhood's candidate selected after Kahirat El-Shater had been disqualified, won Egypt's presidential election. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces acquiesced to his inauguration but demanded the dissolution of Parliament and reserved certain political powers for itself. Morsi would govern for a year before protesters were back in the streets in full force demanding his removal from office. He would be deposed in a military coup the next month. In the fall of 2012, he had given himself powers to legislate in the absence of Parliament without judicial review, and to control, also without judicial review, the writing of a new constitution for Egypt. Protests erupted immediately as secularist politicians accused Morsi of presidential tyranny. The new constitution, ratified by a Brotherhood-controlled constitutional assembly, confirmed their fears. Morsi had refused to make concessions to secularists, liberals, moderates, or the courts. The Constitution gave greater powers to the president at the expense of the judiciary and extended them to areas that had been the purview of the military. It declared Sharia law as the basis for all laws and gave the government responsibility to ensure public morality. More protests ensued. The situation was rapidly deteriorating when I went back to Egypt with a large delegation concerned about the recent turn of events for the primary purpose of meeting with Morsi to state our concerns. In addition to his aggregation of powers and the decidedly Islamist constitution he had secured, attacks on Egypt's Coptic Christian community by Islamist extremists were multiplying and would escalate the following year. Compounding the problem was the recent disclosure of anti-Semitic remarks Morsi had made a couple years earlier. He had called Israelis bloodsuckers and the descendants of apes and pigs. Morsi claimed he had been quoted out of context. It was hard to imagine what an appropriate context might have been. The meeting was long and did not prove particularly productive. We had to explain to him why Americans were upset over his anti-Semitic statements, and that provoked an extended monologue about the Muslim Brotherhood view of Israel. Morsi had pledged as a candidate that he would keep the peace with Israel and honor Egypt's Camp David commitments, but it was clear he was more accustomed to the Brotherhood's militant view of Israel. We emphasized, too, the necessity of compromise and concession to successful governance. But I left the meeting with a strong feeling that the Brotherhood's hold on power was going to be very brief. Before we left Egypt, we met with the new defense minister who had replaced General Tantawi. I didn't know Abdel Fattah el-Sisi as well as I had known Tantawi. I'm certain we had met once or twice on my many trips to Egypt, but I couldn't recall any exchanges of interest we might have had. I would see Sisi again in August, a month after public protests had exploded. Millions of demonstrators in Cairo had demanded Morsi's ouster, many of them surrounding the presidential palace, and the military had stepped in to enforce the people's will. Pro-Morsi demonstrators took to the street to demand his restoration and clashed with anti-Morsi crowds. The violence that ensued looked like it might plunge the country into a very dark time. Lindsay and I flew there to appeal to both sides to step back from the brink. The army had already jailed Morsi and many other senior Brotherhood figures. protests were still raging for and against Morsi. Our message to the Muslim Brotherhood was, you were forced out by widespread popular demand that gave the military the opening because you dug in your heels and wouldn't make concessions. Don't compound the mistake by turning to violence. Let the Egyptian people see you call for reconciliation and cooperation. You can't win an armed confrontation. Our message to Sisi was, be magnanimous in victory. The country couldn't continue in this direction. It will become ungovernable. You've got the upper hand. Reach out and try to separate the Islamists you can work with from the intractable extremists. We asked his permission to meet with Morsi. He didn't say no explicitly, but he made it clear he wasn't going to allow it. He gave the impression of being a pretty cold-blooded individual, and there was a lot of ego inside the uniform he was wearing. In his view, the country was going off the rails, and he had stepped in heroically to rescue it. He was the nation's savior, and now he was going to do what was necessary to end the chaos and insecurity. He didn't say, I'm going to arrest every Muslim Brotherhood member I can get my hands on and kill a lot of people in the process, but he communicated clearly to us that the country needed order, and he was going to accomplish that, and he didn't really care who he had to destroy to do it or what we thought about it. It was an ominous exchange, and it was clear in which direction things were heading. Deputy Secretary of State Bill Burns, one of the most capable members of the Obama foreign policy team, was in Egypt at the same time and agreed with our assessment. We discussed with our ambassador, Ann Patterson, how we should answer the inevitable question we were going to get at a press availability we had scheduled. Do we consider the military's intervention a coup? We both thought, as undiplomatic as that would sound to the generals, there really wasn't anything else we could call it. Anne worried that no one would hear any other part of our message, including our calls for dialogue and national reconciliation. They would just hear the word coup. One side would be offended and the other incited. There was truth in her concern. But there really wasn't anything else we could call it. The Egyptian armed forces had removed an elected president from office, arrested him and his associates, and assumed governing authority. That's a textbook definition of a military coup, and calling it a banana would only sacrifice our credibility. So we called it a coup, and as predicted, our comment blew up in the Egyptian and international media. There were no more meetings with officials in the new regime. We managed to meet with a couple Muslim Brotherhood representatives who weren't in jail yet, and then we left the country. I haven't been back since. Sisi did ask to see Lindsay and me when he was in Washington last year to meet with President Trump. We went to his suite at the Four Seasons. Before the meeting, a Sisi aide had communicated that the president did not wish to discuss the continuing liability of the NDI and IRI staffers. Their convictions had never been overturned, and I regularly remonstrated with Egyptian officials, including Sisi, over that injustice. As long as their convictions stood, any one of them could be subject to an Interpol arrest warrant. It is a damn disgrace, and not the act of an ally, but the purpose of Sisi's trip was to reestablish his legitimacy in the eyes of official Washington. Trump had obliged him. Now he expected Lindsay and me to do the same. To that end, he was pleased to discuss other subjects of mutual interest, but not a matter that would cause him political discomfort for no appreciable gain. As soon as we were ushered into his suite and exchanged greetings, I began to lobby him on the forbidden subject, as did Lindsay. He listened for a while. One of his aides tried to change subjects unsuccessfully, and then Sisi brought the encounter to an abrupt halt with something that sounded vaguely like a threat. Don't damage this relationship, senators. If you do this, it will be on you. I am a stubborn and hard fighter. Needless to say, we left the Four Seasons with little expectation either of us would be going back to Egypt for a while. I made my first trip to Libya in April 2011 over the initial objections of the Obama administration. I had wanted to go to Benghazi since Joe and I had endorsed U.S. military intervention in the Civil War. The administration, understandably, was reluctant to have a U.S. senator in the country while a civil war was raging, even if Benghazi was in rebel hands. Chris Stevens, the administration's special envoy to the Provisional Libyan Rebel Government, the National Transitional Council, NTC, was there, as was a USAID team. So there was something like an official U.S. diplomatic presence in Benghazi that could coordinate my visit and see to it that I didn't wander into any real harm. Nevertheless, my repeated insistence that I be allowed to go was met with repeated resistance until the Qataris offered to fly me into the city. I informed the administration I would be traveling to Benghazi courtesy of the Emir of Qatar, at which point they relented and arranged to fly me from Crete to Benghazi. I spent a night in Crete where, at the insistence of the administration, my Navy escort officer, Captain Jim Loebline, remained behind. The president had maintained since the announcement that the U.S. would fly airstrikes that no American ground troops would be deployed to any operation in Libya. Apparently, the prohibition extended to a surface warfare naval officer assigned to staff a U.S. senator. We flew to Benghazi without him early the next morning on an old Dash 8 turboprop that belonged to our embassy in Baghdad. I should be more specific. This was my first visit to Libya since the rebellion began, and I would make 5 more trips there over the next 3 years. But it was not my first trip ever to Libya. That had been a visit I made to the country 2 years before, when I had one of the more unusual meetings with a head of state I have ever had, a round midnight discussion with Muammar Gaddafi in his desert compound outside Tripoli. Joe, Lindsay, Susan Collins, and I had been scheduled to depart the hotel for the meeting at 4 o'clock, but were informed by our foreign ministry minder that Brother Leader wasn't prepared to meet with us yet and that we should delay our departure a little while. 5 o'clock arrived, and we were instructed to wait a bit longer. 6 o'clock, still not ready. 7 o'clock, the same. And again at 8 o'clock. Finally, as 9 o'clock arrived, I announced to my colleagues, our embassy officials, and our Libyan hosts that unless we left within the hour, I was going to bed. Since we were leaving Libya in the morning, we would have to forego the pleasure of the Brother Leader's company on this visit. That seemed to have an effect on the Libyans, and a little before 10 o'clock, we were in a motorcade speeding through the desert on a deserted highway in total darkness for 45 minutes en route to the Bab al-Zizia compound. We learned later that we had taken a circuitous route to delay the meeting until Gaddafi was at last ready to receive us. Finally, we approached an army base where bright stadium lights had turned night into day, illuminating a polo match underway. And not the water sport variety, but the one with riders and ponies and mallets. It was an unusual sight, given the circumstances. We passed the polo field and turned down a road that led to a dirt track, which we continued on for about a mile, until we reached Gaddafi's tent, which to my eyes appeared to be a Winnebago RV. We met with Gaddafi's son first, who served as his national security advisor, and 2 other aides. The discussion continued for a half hour or so until at long last our night owl host entered the room wearing white jeans and a black shirt with little green maps of Africa on it. He gave a rambling presentation that included references to a plot by Bulgarian nurses to infect Libyan children with the HIV virus. He began with an observation that had I not supported the surge in Iraq, I would have been elected president. Gaddafi had voluntarily surrendered his weapons of mass destruction in 2003, including a nuclear program, and there had been intermittent efforts since then to have something like normal relations with his government. There was some talk about improving security cooperation, but the only topic that gained any traction with the mercurial dictator concerned one of the bombers who had destroyed Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Britain was about to release him from prison for medical reasons, and we warned Gaddafi that were he given a hero's welcome in Tripoli, it would have a very bad effect on public opinion in the U.S. Gaddafi responded that he could not control the Libyan people's reaction, to which Joe responded, "That may be, but then we won't be able to control the American people's reaction either." Gaddafi ended the meeting not long after that exchange. We drove back to the hotel, and half the time it had taken us to get there. I hadn't known Chris Stevens before I met him in Benghazi, although he had worked on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as a Foreign Service Fellow. He was a talented diplomat and an exceptional human being. He believed in what he was doing, supporting the Libyan people's rights to freedom and justice, and helping them build an open society, and he was effective. I was bound to like the guy. We had the same hopes for Libya and the same faith and optimism they could achieve them. He was a go-getter, a risk-taker who didn't wait on events but tried to shape them. He was positive, good-humored, and fun to be with. I liked and admired him a great deal, and I miss him very much. The NATO air campaign was then about a month old. It had begun after the head of the provisional government, the National Transitional Council, had implored the West to establish a no-fly zone in eastern Libya and protect civilian populations. Gaddafi, who was moving armored and infantry columns to Benghazi from the south, had threatened to show Benghazi no mercy. He swore he would go door to door to snuff out the rats. When Joe and I had returned from that first trip to Egypt, we worked with John Kerry to get an understanding from the Pentagon of what enforcing a no-fly zone in Libya would entail, and to build support for it in the Senate and the White House. Toward that end, Kerry and I sponsored a bipartisan resolution authorizing the use of military force in Libya for a year. Inside the administration, UN Ambassador Samantha Power, National Security Advisor Susan Rice, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton were the strongest advocates for intervention. France and the UK were the first NATO countries to call for airstrikes. They introduced a resolution in the UN Security Council approving a no-fly zone and authorizing all necessary means to protect civilians, but expressly ruling out the use of ground forces. In response, and hoping to head off the inevitable, the Libyan foreign minister announced a ceasefire the next day. It was seen as an obvious ruse, as the regime continued operations against a rebel-held city in western Libya, Misrata, and armor and ground troops were still approaching Benghazi. The French struck first on March 19th, hitting regime forces converging on Benghazi. The U.S., U.K., and seven other countries also struck targets that day, with the U.S. planes concentrating on Gaddafi's air defenses and airfields, while the U.S. Sixth Fleet imposed a blockade of Libya's ports. The U.S. Africa Command commanded the operations that first week. But by March 25th, President Obama made the decision to transfer control of the campaign, which had expanded to include 19 nations, to NATO under the command of a Canadian Air Force general. He explained his reasoning for intervening in Libya in a speech to the nation on March 28th, announcing at the same time that NATO had assumed command and the U.S. would, from that point on, play a supporting role. Our allies would take the lead in enforcing the no-fly zone and protecting civilians. The U.S. would provide arms and supplies and fly most of the aerial refueling missions, but France, the U.K., and our other partners would fly the ground attack sorties. A couple days before the speech, my foreign policy aide, Chris Brose, told me he had received a call from a contact in the French embassy alerting him that the U.S. was withdrawing from a combat role. "They're giving command to NATO," Brose explained. I had a flashback to a point in the Balkans crisis in the 1990s when the U.N. had authority over NATO air operations in Bosnia, and things had gotten thoroughly screwed up until we intervened and took command. At an Armed Services Committee hearing that day, I asked one of the witnesses to confirm the U.S. role in the operation. "We're acting in support of NATO," he explained. "In support of NATO," I repeated incredulously. "We are NATO." An anonymous White House staffer defending the decision described the administration approach as leading from behind, a phrase that would come back to haunt them as it became shorthand for the general retrenchment and risk-averse nature of Obama's world leadership and the power vacuums it created. I would make mocking reference to the term more than once over the next several years. The NATO air campaign was ongoing when I arrived in Benghazi and would continue until Gaddafi was captured and killed in October. He hadn't been able to lay waste to the city as he had threatened, and Benghazi looked to me like any other rundown Arab city. Chris and his team had commandeered a dilapidated hotel as their headquarters, and he brought in a rotating cast of rebel leadership to meet us there. I was impressed by Mahmoud Jibril, who headed the NTC, essentially as provisional prime minister. He was a technocrat, sophisticated and widely traveled, with a doctorate from the University of Pittsburgh. He was a prominent moderating voice in rebel councils. Hillary Clinton had met with him in advance of the president's decision to intervene, and reportedly the impression he had made had helped convince her to support the decision. I went to a local hospital to visit wounded rebels and met with the folks from Human Rights Watch and the Libyans they were helping build a civil society. Every Libyan I encountered was excited and positive that their deliverance from decades of oppression and corruption was at hand. If there was a spirit of the Arab Spring that Americans could relate to, a people's confident belief in their ability to shape their own destiny, it was present in Benghazi. The Libyans I met were certain they were up to the challenge of defeating the regime and ready for the difficult task of building a modern, free, and just society that would realize the most hopeful visions of the Arab Spring. They were thankful, too, for the help that had come from the West. I walked around Benghazi's Freedom Square with one of the rebel leaders. I looked at photographs of Libyans killed by the regime or missing in action that covered a wall of a nearby government building. A crowd of 100 or so chanted, "Thank you, McCain. Thank you, Obama. We need freedom." I suspect the NTC had played a role in organizing the cheerleaders, but I enjoyed the experience just the same, noting to my guide that I hadn't had many occasions to hear my name and the president's chanted by the same people. "It's usually just one or the other of us," I explained. "We don't always have the same fans." I had agreed that I wouldn't remain overnight in Benghazi. I departed for Cairo that evening, certain we were right to have intervened, and more hopeful than I had been before I arrived that a better Libya could emerge from the destruction of Gaddafi's regime. Before I left, I agreed to hold a press conference. "We have prevented the worst outcome," I said. "Now we have to increase our support so that the Libyan people can achieve the only satisfactory outcome to this mass protest for universal rights, the end of Gaddafi's rule, and the beginning of a peaceful and inclusive transition to democracy that will benefit all Libyans." By the time I returned to Libya in September, Tripoli had fallen. We had just reopened our embassy, although it had been moved to temporary quarters because Gaddafi's forces had ransacked the building. We met with our ambassador, Gene Kretz, a career Foreign Service officer who had been forced to leave Libya even before NATO operations had begun. Cables he had written documenting Gaddafi's corruption were disclosed in a massive WikiLeaks dump, which had also incidentally disclosed a cable reporting our strange encounter with Gaddafi in 2009. I asked to inspect a prison where 1,500 Libyans were detained after they had been arrested by rebel militias. Human Rights Watch had recently conducted interviews with some of the prisoners and found many had been arrested for dubious reasons and held without trial. Many had also been physically mistreated. In the days just after Tripoli's fall, there wasn't a central authority directing militias. They were acting on their own, more or less. The NTC had been based in Benghazi. I was encouraged that I had been allowed into the prison, but it was clear that militias were still acting independently from the NTC. When we met with Mahmoud Jibril, he acknowledged the difficulties in controlling the militias and promised the council would get control of the situation. We had again been requested not to remain in Libya overnight, and before we left that evening, we walked around Green Square, renamed by the rebels Martyrs Square. It was crowded. Militia were everywhere, and lots of folks were selling stuff on the street. No one knew we were coming this time. But as soon as we got out of our vehicles, they started chanting, "Thank you, America. We love America. Thank you, Obama. We love Obama." And Lindsay quipped to one effusive Libyan, "I love America, too." Gaddafi was making a last stand in his hometown of Sirte. In a month, rebels found him hiding in a drainpipe and killed him as he begged for his life. NATO operations ceased at the end of October. I was proud of what we'd accomplished. At the point when Gaddafi's forces had been retaking control of the country, while a vanguard of armor and infantry approached the outskirts of Benghazi, which would have ended in a massacre, NATO air power had intervened and reversed the tide. Over 7 months, NATO had acted as the revolution's air force, obliterating the regime's advantage in armor and heavy weaponry. The rebel forces improved and fought well as the war went on, but it was NATO that had ensured regime change, irrespective of official insistence that it had not been the purpose of our intervention. Protecting Libyan civilians, which had been the Security Council's mandate, required overthrowing Gaddafi, and it was sophistry to pretend otherwise. I came back again for another brief visit in February. That was the trip when I had asked to meet with Abdel Belhaj, the Libyan militia leader whose wife had been abused by the CIA. But the most memorable of all my experiences in Libya were the 2 days I spent in Tripoli in July 2012. I had come to observe Libya's first free election. It was just Chris Broz, Captain Loblein, and me on that trip. No other senators came with us. We stayed at Chris Stevens' residence. He had succeeded Gene Kretz as ambassador a couple months earlier. He and some other embassy personnel were still living in temporary quarters while the embassy and Chris's official residence were repaired after being torched and painted with anti-American graffiti. They had rented a compound with several villas from an oil company. Each villa had a swimming pool and strikingly exotic decor of leopard skins and couches shaped like lips. No congressional delegation had been allowed to remain in Libya for more than a day, out of concern for their safety. But I had insisted on this trip that I would stay for 2 days and nights, and the State Department had relented. I had been in regular contact with Chris since our first meeting in April of the previous year. We saw Libya the same way. We were both enthusiastic about its prospects, even though it had been ruled by a tyrant for 4 decades and hadn't national institutions that survived his downfall. Libyans would have to build everything from scratch while rival militias and political factions competed for turf. We both believed it was essential for the U.S. to be engaged in that project, using the relationships we had made in Libya over the last year and our soft power resources to support national reconciliation and the rule of law. Chris was a California native with a stereotypical Californian's sunny disposition. He had graduated from Berkeley. He had been a Peace Corps volunteer in Morocco. His politics were decidedly liberal, but we didn't discuss American politics much. He was good company and a gracious host. The morning of the election, he made us cappuccinos, knowing it was my preferred variety of caffeine. I've kept a picture that Broz took of Chris making us the coffees. We spent all day visiting polling sites, watching Libyans cast votes that actually mattered for the first time in their lives. They had showed up in encouraging numbers. There were long lines at all the polls we visited, and despite the huge turnout, it appeared to be a very orderly election. Embassy staff and international observers had fanned out across the country. There were a few isolated instances of problems and boycotting here and there by some rebel factions, but on the whole, they reported the same good turnout, well-run process, and enthusiastic voters we were finding everywhere we looked in Tripoli. It was awesome. Mahmoud Jibril's party would win the most seats, which I took as an encouraging sign. We had dinner that night on the patio of a restaurant adjacent to the Marcus Aurelius Arch that the Romans had built in AD 165 to commemorate their victories over the Parthians. We went for a walk after dinner. Everywhere Libyans were celebrating their freedom, hanging out car windows, waving flags, honking their horns, shooting off fireworks, cheering us. I don't know how many of the people who cheered and thanked us or stopped to pose for a picture with us knew exactly who we were. They just seemed to know we were Americans, and it helped make this day possible. It was a lovely, hopeful evening, and one of my favorite memories. 2 months later, Chris was dead. Most readers know the story, so I won't go into detail here. He went to Benghazi on September 11th. He had worried about the deteriorating situation there as rival militias clashed and reports warned of a growing al-Qaeda presence. The central government, in office for a month, appeared too weak to do much about it. Al-Qaeda had recently called for attacks on Americans as the anniversary of September 11 approached. Chris had asked the State Department for more security for the Benghazi mission, but it had been denied. On the evening of the 11th, an al-Qaeda offshoot attacked the main U.S. mission compound in Benghazi and a CIA annex about a mile away with grenades, RPGs, mortars, and automatic rifles. The attackers entered the building where Chris was hiding, poured gasoline, and torched it. Chris was killed, as was an embassy information officer, Sean Smith. Two former Navy SEALs helping to evacuate Americans at the CIA annex, Glenn Doherty and Tyrone Woods, were subsequently killed. Libyans discovered Chris's body, believed him to be alive, and tried to rescue him. He was pronounced dead at the hospital from smoke inhalation. I heard about what had happened the same way most Americans did, from news reports. In those first days after his death, I was just terribly saddened by it. I wasn't angry with the administration. I remember listening to Secretary Clinton's memorial remarks about him and being very moved by them, and I asked Chris Broz to send her a note of thanks. I started to get angry when it appeared administration officials were knowingly misleading us about the attack, attributing it to a video that some idiot had made mocking Islam that incited a spontaneous mob that turned violent. It took more than a week for the White House to acknowledge it had been a planned terrorist attack. The uproar that ensued became a lasting political controversy that's still debated. I was one of the most vocal critics, calling the administration's analysis willful ignorance or abysmal intelligence, and a massive cover-up or incompetence. I demanded that a special committee investigate it. In the end, all it established is what could have been presumed at the beginning, bureaucratic incompetence and ass-covering. Two common conditions in Washington. Anger subsides, politics move on, but sadness remains. Chris Stevens deserved better from all of us. And what of the country he died trying to help? It disintegrated into anarchy as warring militias clashed, politicians feuded, rival legislators contested for control, and ISIS exploited the chaos to establish a franchise operation in the country. Libyans who were ecstatic over their enfranchisement in 2012 showed up in reduced numbers to vote in 2014, half as many as 2 years before. The U.S. and Europe, having intervened to change the regime, disengaged from the urgent, complex task of transforming a terrorized nation into a functioning civil society, of helping Libyans build national institutions where none existed. A UN-brokered agreement in 2015 called for a new government of national accord, and a new constitution and election that various warring factions continued to hinder. ISIS lost its territory but remains a presence. Last September, a new UN reconciliation plan was announced. A little hopefulness flickers in the embers that that the worst might be behind. The memory of the heady optimism of 2011 that gave way quickly to resignation and despair cautions against great expectations. But that's not to say there are no Libyans left who believe in the promise of 2011. There are many who still have faith they are capable of building a modern democracy. I do too. I've met them and been inspired by them and believe in them. They need other Libyans to believe in their future too, and assistance from the West to help them build it. They need guidance and resources and security. They need time. They need the generosity and vision of Chris Stevens, reflected in the efforts of those who emulate the example of that good man. As NATO contemplated whether to intervene in Libya in March 2011, the first large protests in Syria began in provincial towns. 15 kids were arrested in Deraa in the southwest corner of the country for scrawling anti-regime graffiti on school walls. Protesters marched to demand their release. Government security forces opened fire on them, killing several. More protesters marched in response, and police fired on them too, killing scores. Protests proliferated nationwide, as did demands for Bashar al-Assad's resignation. The regime responded to the demonstrations with force. The casualties climbed as Alawite Assad made war on the majority of his countrymen, who were Sunni. 100,000 demonstrated in Homs, the country's third largest city. By the summer, as many as 1 million Syrians were marching. The regime was using tanks to put down the protests. The U.S. and Europe imposed sanctions on the regime. President Obama called for Assad to step down. Syrian army officers defected and formed the Free Syrian Army, FSA, and civil war ensued. In January 2012, they were fighting in the Damascus suburbs. In February, the army began shelling Homs, starting the offensive to retake the city that would kill thousands, and was described by an evacuated British journalist as a scene of medieval siege and slaughter. In May, pro-regime forces executed over 100 Syrians, most of them women and children, in the town of Taldu in the Hula region of Syria. Syria's descent into hell was nearing the point of no return when I spoke on the Senate floor in March 2012 to argue for arming the Free Syrian Army and call for airstrikes by the U.S., and our European and regional allies to ground the Syrian Air Force, which was indiscriminately bombing population centers. I proposed creating safe havens for opposition forces and refugees. We had reached a decisive moment in the conflict, I began. 7,500 lives had been lost, and the regime was committing crimes against humanity. Most of the world had turned against Assad. The Arab League had expelled Syria, and the UN General Assembly had rebuked the regime, though Russia and China used their vetoes to protect Assad in the Security Council. The Russians hadn't yet intervened militarily, though Moscow and Beijing were supplying arms and other assistance to the regime. Syria is Iran's only ally in the Arab world, and Iran's proxy, Hezbollah, had deployed fighters to the conflict. There were already Revolutionary Guard officers in Syria, but the full extent of Iran's involvement was a year away. ISIS hadn't yet exploited the conflict to establish the center of its caliphate. Had the U.S. and Europe intervened in that first year of the conflict, eliminated Assad's air power advantage, and provided the FSA arms and munitions, including anti-tank weapons, I believe it would have been decisive. The regime would have collapsed, and Assad, if he had survived, would likely have fled the country. Hundreds of thousands of lives might have been spared. I commended the administration for leading international diplomatic and economic pressure on the regime, and I recognized their legitimate concerns about the efficacy of military options in Syria. But the conditions on the ground in Syria were dire, and the administration's approach is starting to look more like hope than a strategy. I criticized the insistence that Assad's collapse was inevitable. Claims about the inevitability of events can often be a convenient way to abdicate responsibility. I argued that in addition to humanitarian concerns, we had important geopolitical interests at stake. As Iran's only Arab ally, Syria serves as a forward operating base for our adversary, and the supply route for our arms to Hezbollah and Hamas, as well as the gateway to Iraq for foreign extremists. The time has come for a new policy, I contended. America and our allies should support both political and military opposition groups. What opposition groups need most urgently is relief from Assad's tanks and artillery sieges in the many cities that are still contested. The only realistic way to do that is with foreign air power. Our goal should be to establish and defend safe havens in the north, where opposition forces can organize and plan, and could serve as platforms for humanitarian and military assistance. I acknowledged we would have to destroy Assad's air defenses in most, if not all, of the country before we could ground his air force. But that wouldn't have been as great a challenge as some in the administration were suggesting it would be. We had to act now. With Iran's and Russia's backing, Assad had regained the momentum. The world was hedging their bets on Syria, waiting for our leadership. The president had to make clear by word and deed that Assad will not be able to finish what he started. Are there dangers and risks and uncertainties in this approach? Absolutely. There are no ideal options in Syria. All of them contain significant risk, but none so much that they should keep us from acting. And the risks get worse the longer we wait. The surest way for al-Qaeda to gain a foothold in Syria is for us to turn our backs on the Syrians fighting to defend themselves. Sunni Iraqis were willing to ally with al-Qaeda when they felt desperate enough. But when America gave them a better alternative, they turned their guns on al-Qaeda. Concerns that the civil war was a sectarian conflict and our intervention would allow Sunnis to take bloody revenge against their Alawite persecutors were legitimate, too. But that threat would only grow worse the longer the conflict lasts. As we saw in Iraq or Lebanon before it, time favors the hardliners in a conflict like this. The worse the Sunnis suffered, the stronger the calls for revenge become, and the more it incentivizes the Alawites to keep fighting. And to those who argued all our intervention would do is further militarize the conflict, I noted that Iran and Russia were doing just that and could be counted on to continue strengthening Assad's killing machine. These warnings all came to pass, I'm sorry to say. Every concern raised as an argument against U.S. intervention became reality in the absence of our action. Al-Qaeda's role in the opposition grew stronger as non-extremist militias were compelled by necessity to join forces with it. Foreign jihadists flooded into Syria, and ISIS claimed a huge swath of Syrian territory for its barbarous caliphate. The role Iran and Russia played in Syria escalated with every passing month until the regime's dependence on them was total, and the slaughter surpassed imagination. By the summer, fighting had spread to Aleppo, Syria's then largest city. The regime ordered fixed-wing airstrikes on rebel positions there and in Damascus, indiscriminate bombing that killed as many civilians as rebels. By the end of the year, another 50,000 Syrians had perished in the conflict. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimated that over 750,000 Syrians had fled the country, and hundreds of thousands more were displaced within Syria. Citing concerns that they could fall into the hands of terrorists, the administration continued to reject calls to intervene and to arm the Free Syrian Army with anything more than light arms and non-lethal assistance when they desperately needed anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons. Obama did announce in August that one thing could change his mind about intervening. "We have been very clear to the Assad regime," he stated, "that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus, that would change my equation. By February 2013, the UN Security Council estimated that over 70,000 civilians had been killed directly and indirectly by the war. For a year now, Lindsay, Joe, and I had continued our appeals to arm and train the opposition and for a no-fly zone. In response to administration reluctance to expose U.S. pilots to Syria's air defenses, I recommended using Patriot missile batteries in Turkey to shoot down Syrian warplanes. In every conversation, every committee hearing, every private discussion with senior members of the administration, I was told over and over that a no-fly zone was practically impossible. We would have to roll back all Assad's air defenses, destroy his command and control, bomb all his airfields, crater all his runways. It would take months before we could safely defend safe havens. In essence, the administration's pushback was that grounding Assad's air force and defending a no-fly zone was too complex and dangerous for the greatest air power in the world to manage safely and quickly. And this was more than 2 years before Russia's first airstrikes in Syria. It was a ridiculous assertion. Rebel forces had gained the momentum by early 2013 and were advancing on multiple fronts. But Hezbollah fighters rushed to Assad's aid. In April, the regime launched an offensive, and the opposition's advance had stalled. I had made a few trips to Turkey by then to meet with members of the Syrian political opposition and with humanitarian workers, including a young Syrian from Homs, Abu Salim, a nom de guerre, who regularly ran arms and non-lethal assistance across the border to the FSA. He was an impressive young man, not an Islamist, who appeared to have ample resources and extensive contacts. I met with him several times, including twice in Washington, when he brought members of a Syrian volunteer group he was helping finance to meet me. They would eventually be widely known and admired as the White Helmets. I don't know where Abu Salim is these days or even if he's still using that name. I remember him as someone I hoped would be around when the war was over to help put the country back together. He wasn't a zealot, just a guy who wanted to help his country and took risks. I hope he's well, and if by some coincidence he should ever have an occasion to hear this, I want him to know I admired him and wished him and his country well. From my meetings in Turkey, I grew increasingly worried over reports that Syria might be using chemical weapons, that Iranians were committing more men and resources to the war, and that al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda front, was gaining strength and influence with rebel forces because their fighters were proving the most effective. I was tired of butting up against administration excuses that suppressing Assad's air defenses was too time-consuming and dangerous an undertaking. I spoke on the Senate floor to call for measures that could tip the balance without a full-out assault on Assad's SAMs and anti-aircraft artillery. More than 70,000 Syrians have been killed indiscriminately, I noted. With snipers, artillery, helicopter gunships, fighter jets, and even ballistic missiles. Indeed, more than 4,300 civilians have been killed by Assad's airstrikes alone since July 2012. At the same time, Iran and its proxy Hezbollah are building a network of militias inside Syria, and the al-Qaeda-aligned al-Nusra front has gained unprecedented strength on the ground. According to estimates that have been published in the media, some believe there were no more than a few hundred al-Nusra fighters in Syria last year. But today, it is widely believed that there could be thousands of extremist fighters inside Syria. I talked about the hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees who were overwhelming Jordan and Lebanon. Syria is becoming a failed state in the heart of the Middle East, I warned, overrun by thousands of al-Qaeda-affiliated fighters with possibly tons of chemical weapons and poised to ignite a wider sectarian conflict that could profoundly destabilize the region. We didn't have to take out the regime's air defenses, I argued, to arm and train vetted opposition forces which was something the president's entire national security team had recommended he do, but that he continued to resist. And we could use precision strike capabilities to target Assad's aircraft and Scud launchers without suppressing his defenses. And we could use them against artillery, too, and use Patriot batteries to defend safe zones from aerial and missile attacks. Would any of these options immediately end the conflict? Probably not. But they could save innocent lives in Syria. They could give the moderate opposition a better chance to succeed in marginalizing radical actors. I went to Turkey at the end of the month after convincing the State Department to let me enter northern Syria for a few hours. The Washington-based Syrian Emergency Task Force had arranged for me to meet with members of FSA units. I went with General Salim Idris, the head of the FSA's Supreme Military Council. I don't know what I had expected, but crossing the border into a war turned out to be a pretty unremarkable experience. General Idris, Rose, two Syrian Emergency Task Force staffers, and I loaded into SUVs and drove less than a mile to a border crossing where the guards were expecting us. They raised the gates and we crossed into Syria, and with that easy effort, I became, for the time being, the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Syria since the war began. Another short drive took us to the building where FSA commanders from around the country had gathered to meet us. They described recent fighting on various fronts where the regime was trying to retake territory, and how increasingly large a share of the fighting Hezbollah was conducting. They were doing all of the fighting in homes, they said. There were more Russians in the country as well. They told me they were running low on ammunition and didn't have weapons they could use against aircraft. They also insisted Assad had already used chemical weapons several times. They asked me for the things I had been arguing for months they'd be provided with, anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons and airstrikes. I told them I'd keep at it. We took a few photographs and then we left for another uneventful border crossing. When I got back to the hotel, I instructed my Washington office to tweet one of the pictures. I don't remember exactly how long it took, but some days, if not weeks later, a Lebanese television station affiliated with Hezbollah accused two of the FSA commanders of being al-Nusra fighters who had been involved in kidnapping Shia pilgrims to Lebanon. The names mentioned didn't match any of the names of the people we had met with, and we soon determined the story was bullshit. But it lives forever on the internet in easy reach of McCain-hating conspiracy nuts everywhere. Some troll even went to the trouble of photoshopping the head of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi onto the body of one of the FSA leaders. In the pre-dawn hours of August 21, 2013, the regime fired as many as 15 rockets at two densely populated rebel-held areas in the Damascus suburbs. They carried warheads filled with sarin gas. It wasn't long before video and photographs appeared of some of the victims, many of them children, gasping their last breaths. As many as 1,500 civilians were massacred. Assad denied his regime was culpable and blamed the attacks on the rebels, as did Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, whom I've gotten to know over the years at conferences in Munich and elsewhere, and who lies as easily as he breathes. But a UN inspection team confirmed that a sarin gas attack on sleeping civilians had occurred. On August 30th, U.S. intelligence services revealed they had surveilled each step in the attack, from preparing the rockets to after-action reports. President Obama's red line had been crossed. I believed he would retaliate as he had promised, and I hoped the force used to punish the regime would seriously degrade its military capabilities. The president was reported to have decided on military action, and the strikes were thought to be imminent when he abruptly announced in the Rose Garden that he would ask Congress for authorization first. The day before, British Prime Minister David Cameron had lost a vote in Parliament authorizing military action against Syria. Americans were war-weary. Republicans were restive and not often disposed to vote for the president's policies, whatever they were. Lindsay and I released a statement on the day of his announcement, August 31st, urging a military response that would help change momentum on the battlefield, and saying we wouldn't support a few isolated cruise missile strikes, the damage from which could be quickly repaired and forgotten. The president asked us to the White House on the following Monday, Labor Day. It was just Lindsay and me, the president, and National Security Advisor Susan Rice. The plan they laid out to us was surprisingly substantial. The strikes from carrier aircraft and cruise missiles would not be lasting, but they would be big enough to degrade Assad's military capabilities. They were going to hit airfields, runways, Scud batteries, and command and control, seriously degrading Assad's air power. All the targets they had been insisting for years couldn't be touched without taking out the regime's air defenses. They were also going to upgrade assistance to the FSA, providing it weapons it had long needed, and train them far more seriously. They weren't prepared to create a no-fly zone, but I was satisfied that the plan would change the war's momentum, and I welcomed it. We held an impromptu press conference on the White House driveway, and I said the consequences of a vote against authorization would be catastrophic. A weak response, I added, would also be catastrophic. Without disclosing details, I intimated that the strikes the president was contemplating would be serious rather than cosmetic. We had been told the attacks were likely to launch in 2 days. We both got a call from General Dempsey a day later saying they had been delayed. The authorization never received a vote by the full Senate. It was approved by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on September 4 by a vote of 10-7. Both the ayes and nays were bipartisan. I had amended the resolution to include authorization for a use of force sufficient to change momentum on the battlefield. The president called it all off not long after. An aside by Secretary of State John Kerry that military action wouldn't be necessary if Assad surrendered his chemical weapons arsenal led to an offer from Sergei Lavrov to broker an agreement with Assad. Assad agreed to do it and to join the Chemical Weapons Convention. He was lying, of course. The administration insisted the deal was a breakthrough and commended it with every load of chemical weapons surrendered. But Assad retained some of his arsenal and used chemical weapons again on his people. Neither Lindsay nor I received a heads-up that the president had changed his mind. It was the worst decision of his presidency, I believe, and its consequences are felt to this day. His administration's credibility in the region was lost, and with some of the region's worst actors. It shook the confidence of our allies and emboldened our adversaries, no one more so than Vladimir Putin. For the next couple years, the administration's policy for Syria was reduced to pleading with Russia to help convince Syria to negotiate a settlement to the war. Lavrov and Putin would string us along and never deliver. In September 2015, Putin jumped into the war with both feet. Russian airstrikes on rebel targets in northwest Syria were the first act in Russia's decisive intervention in the conflict. Henceforth, Russian bombers would serve as Assad's air force. Moscow maintained it had intervened to fight ISIS and other terrorist groups fighting in Syria, but their attacks were usually focused on the FSA and other rebel militias that are part of the moderate opposition. Their intervention turned the tide of the war in the regime's favor. Russian air power used to devastating effect on rebel-held cities such as Palmyra and Aleppo was indispensable to retaking the ruins of those ancient metropolises. Moreover, Putin had used his bombers as instruments of terror, deliberately targeting hospitals and school rescue efforts, dropping cluster and barrel bombs, cheap, unguided munitions, indiscriminately in civilian areas. Last December, Russia's defense minister confirmed that Russia would maintain permanent air and naval bases in Syria, giving the Russians a military presence in the Middle East they haven't had since Anwar al-Sadat kicked them out of Egypt. In December 2016, rebel forces in Aleppo negotiated a ceasefire with the Russians to allow them to evacuate civilians and themselves from the destroyed city. ISIS had begun seizing territory in northern and eastern